Good evening. The stock market takes another plunge. Hate spreads across America, and some say the source is in the White House. And residents of Chinatown gear up to save their neighborhood. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo, and this is the news for Thursday, October 11th, 2018. The Dow Jones average, a way of measuring the value of stocks, fell nearly 600 points Thursday afternoon. That was on top of yesterday's precipitous drop of 832 points. Stocks belonging to technology companies led the decline. The tech sector is considered the most volatile part of the market. Business news sites have been pegging the decline to a move by the Federal Reserve to raise interest rates. The rate charged by banks by the government had been near zero since the economy crashed in 2008, but has been going up of late. The largest psychiatric hospital in Florida was left inaccessible as Hurricane Michael carved its path across the panhandle, knocking out power and ripping buildings to shreds. Rescue workers have been dropping pallets of food and water to the facility via helicopter, where nearly 40% of all state mental health patients live. Meanwhile, as the storm shut down transportation in the western part of Florida, a federal judge refused to extend the statewide deadline for voter registration in response to a suit by the state Democratic Party. GOP Governor Rick Scott has extended the Tuesday deadline by one day, but the Democratic Secretary of State called the one-day extension insufficient. He said thousands of eligible voters could be disenfranchised. And the contest for a new governor in Florida has become even more bitter as the campaign of Andrew Gillum, mayor of Tallahassee, sent a cease and desist letter to TV stations demanding they pull a GOP ad accusing Gillum of being corrupt. The ad claims that Gillum is running from the FBI. Gillum's opponent, Ron DeSantis, has resorted to various racist dog whistles from the start, telling voters the Democrats would monkey this up the night of Gillum's historic primary win. It was also revealed that DeSantis was an administrator of a Tea Party Facebook page that featured racist memes targeting First Lady Michelle Obama. DeSantis says he was added to the page without his knowledge. And in New York City, hundreds of thousands of immigrants who feared they would soon face deportation got a reprieve last week. U.S. District Judge Edward Chen granted a preliminary injunction stopping the government from terminating temporary protected status, or TPS, for immigrants from Sudan, El Salvador, Haiti, and Nicaragua. In his ruling Wednesday, Chen said there's evidence that the administration may have violated the Constitution when it made decisions to end TPS. On Thursday, Representative Adriano Espaillat, immigration activists and TPS recipients, held a press conference at the Harlem State Office Building to update residents of his Upper Manhattan district.
TPS is temporary protected status, which grants immigrants from countries like El Sudan, Salvador, Haiti, and Nicaragua the ability to stay in the United States because they're either fleeing violence, war, death, or a natural disaster. And so recently, the Trump administration attempted to do away with the TPS program, but a federal court in California, Judge Edward Chang, recently granted a preliminary injunction stopping the government from terminating the temporary protected status.
Who are some of the people who are under this TPS program?
There are people that fled the civil war in El Salvador or the earthquake in Haiti or in Sudan, the drought and the famine there, and in Nicaragua also violence there as well. And so these are folks that were either here in the United States or got here fleeing these horrible conditions. And now they're, because of this court order, they're able to stay here without facing potential deportation.
What would happen if they lost this TPS status?
The TPS status maintains employment authorization for the beneficiaries. And currently, there's also a lawsuit in Boston for Honduras. We're optimistic that it will grant them the same kind of protection that this court order injunction provided for the other countries. And it protects migrants in the United States from countries that have been hit by conditions such as epidemics, war, and natural disaster, and they're able to stay here legally. Every 2 years, they have to renew their TPS. The Honduran TPS case was a separate one. This was the judge's decision only impacts Sudan, El Salvador, Haiti, and Nicaragua. There is a court case in Boston, Massachusetts, regarding Honduras as well.
What is Congress doing about this?
We were able to, obviously the court stepped in. We have legislation pending that would have granted similar stoppage of potential deportation. But fortunately, the courts came in at a time needed and granted the recipients of the TPS what we legislatively wanted to do as well.
How successful have you been legislatively, though?
Well, we're not in a majority, so I don't think that we would have been able to pass that legislation this year unless we're able now to take control of the House of Representatives or the Senate and then govern bipartisanly.
How did the action go at 2 o'clock? Who was there and what happened there?
We had some recipients here, 5 of them, and we had Angela Fernandez, who's the attorney that heads the Washington Heights, the Northern Manhattan Coalition for Immigrants' Rights. And she has been a strong advocate for TPS recipients. They have over 300 TPS recipients that have to go there on a regular basis every 2 years to renew their TPS.
Representative Adriano Espaillat, he represents the 13th Congressional District. Lawyers for TPS immigrants argue that government officials were driven by Trump's America First agenda when they canceled the program. The case is eventually expected to reach the Supreme Court, where there are two Trump nominees that have tipped the court's balance towards conservatives. In national news, there's one issue where President Trump has remained strikingly consistent in the first half of his term: his dislike of Islam and Muslims. Since taking office, there has been a startling jump in violence and hateful incidents against Muslims and other religious minorities across the country. That hateful atmosphere has been consuming the race for governor of Michigan, where Democratic gubernatorial candidate Abdul El Sayed has been accused of having affiliations with the Muslim Brotherhood by his GOP opponent, a charge that the candidate strenuously denies. University of Michigan history professor Juan Cole has just published a book. It's titled Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. Cole's book argues that Islam is a religion that advocates peaceful resolution of conflict. He adds, the climate of hate being fostered in Washington is reminiscent of another time of intolerance in America more than half a century ago.
The technique of McCarthyism in American politics was to create American communism as a huge bogeyman, as something very threatening to people, and which the threat of which was supposedly all around them, and then to use that threat to tag one's political opponents. Primarily, this is something that Republicans did to Democrats, but Democrats sometimes engaged in it as well. To tag your political opponent as connected to this menace. A communist was red, the Democrat was called pink, or, you know, soft on communism or whatever, with the implication that if you elected this person, that you were basically inviting Stalin into the U.S. Congress. And Dick Nixon, back in the 1940s, first got into Congress running on that kind of platform. And now you see all of these Islamophobic ads. I live in Michigan, and Alyssa Slotkin is running here for Congress, and her opponent, Mike Bishop, or people who support him, are trying to turn her into some kind of Muslim terrorist because she was in the Obama administration on counterterrorism.
Should I blame the Republicans or the Democrats or any politician who does something like this, or the people who are gullible enough to believe it?
There's plenty of blame to go along, but I think the primary blame goes on the politician who deploys these demagogic tactics. I mean, we're a democracy, and the founding fathers were very afraid of this kind of technique, and the checks and balances that they built into our system were out of fear that somebody would come along and have the public using these techniques. In fact, the Senate was described as a way of cooling down the House of Representatives because they were afraid that the House, being very close to the people and elected every 2 years, might be a place where you'd see a lot of this kind of demagoguery. So, no, it is the blame of a politician who uses these tactics. And, you know, you don't have to win. We've had lots of very successful politicians who didn't demonize as a way of getting into power. I think it's fair to say that Barack Obama didn't do that kind of thing. No, it's the politicians who are at fault.
In the 50s, people fell for it. There was no real Soviet threat. People wanted to believe there was a Soviet threat. You don't have to be
a genius to understand that 1 billion Muslims are not responsible for 9/11 any more than Christians are responsible for that fellow who shot 9 people in a church. Yet people seem so susceptible to that. Why do you think that is?
Partly is that the American public is, on the whole and by and large, not very well educated. Our school system is not very good. And people are not being taught to think analytically. You know, it's not self-evident to people that they can make these distinctions. They have to be taught to make them. Hatred of foreigners or xenophobia or these things very closely track with lower rates of education. We're falling behind so many other countries with regard to our math and analytical skills. And it has downstream, you know, negative consequences for the economy, because it's the people who can analyze and think rationally that are going to be, you know, making the technological breakthroughs and scientific ones. So the U.S. Could decline as a power if we go on like this.
What has happened that educated the basic analytical education, as you call it, has fallen by the wayside? What
starting about 40 years ago, very wealthy people in the United States decided to enter politics in a way that they really hadn't so much before, and to put pressure on state legislatures to cut back taxes. So you can see it in all of the state universities in every state have been privatized, more or less. The state legislature gives them very little money, and certainly they haven't kept up with inflation. Then the local school systems as well suffer when the state cuts back. And then the war on drugs from the 1970s forward, which was a huge scam, also diverted enormous resources away from education. And even a Republican like Schwarzenegger in California has openly admitted this. There are some negative trends going on where a mantra of cutting taxes, which really means, it usually just means cutting taxes on the very wealthy and then stiffing people on public services, then this war on drugs. Those sorts of policies have really hurt American education at all levels. And one of the outcomes is that then people learn rote, or they don't learn very well, and they don't learn to analyze. And so in this country, 28 Muslim Americans a year have been implicated in some kind of violent politics, usually going abroad to join a violent group. There are 3.5 million Muslim Americans, so this is almost nothing statistically. Whereas 327 people died in mass shootings last year, mostly conducted by people on the far right. So if you had to look around and say, what is the public security threat to the United States? It's certainly the white supremacists, the neo-Nazis, and those sorts of people. And the Muslim Americans don't come on the radar. But any attack that involves Muslim is covered 327 times more intensely in the press than other sorts of violence. I mean, we're basically stalking the Muslims. There's something very peculiar about this irrational fear of them.
Politicians who, as you mentioned earlier, who are taking advantage of that in order to win elections, as happening in your state, Michigan.
There's another case in Southern California where Duncan Hunter, who's been indicted for embezzling $250,000 from his own campaign for vacations and things, is up against someone who is of Mexican and Palestinian heritage, who's a Christian, and his PACs are running ads trying to depict his opponent as a Muslim Brotherhood mole, as a virulent Muslim fundamentalist, and he's a Christian, but just because he has some Arab heritage, they're trying to tag him in that way. So it's really quite disgusting, and the people who are doing it are not, you know, the most upstanding people in Congress.
Are we moving towards fascism? Is this like a blood libel against Muslims that's started with 9/11?
There are those dangers. I mean, since Trump has been elected, there has been a big spike in Islamophobic incidents. And I think the thing to keep in mind is not just Muslims that are at the receiving end. We saw at Charlottesville when people took advantage of Trump's far right wing tendencies to stage a demonstration that they chanted, "Jews will not replace us." So anytime you have a minority like the Muslim Americans being subjected to this kind of hate speech constantly, it's going to spill over onto other minorities as well. And we've seen this Indian Americans being shot and Sikh Americans being shot on the grounds that they might be Muslims, or they look like Muslims, or whatever. And then the anti-Semitic incidents in the United States are much higher even than the Islamophobic ones. And that trend may be increasing. So it's very worrisome when a society starts scapegoating minorities, because it's how the powerful treat the weak that Winston Churchill said that you judge a society.
University of Michigan history professor Juan Cole, author of Muhammad, Prophet of Peace Amid the Clash of Empires. And locally, the city's plan to site a group of five luxury megatowers, one already built in the Two Bridges area of the Lower East Side, is stirring up intense community opposition. Two Bridges is the neighborhood between the Brooklyn and Manhattan bridges near Chinatown. Local activists say they oppose the 80-story skyscrapers they say would permanently change the character of the neighborhood. But the administration of Mayor Bill de Blasio is adamant that the project will go through. Zisha Ning is with the Chinatown Working Group. He says Chinatown, one of the last relatively low-rent areas in Manhattan, is a neighborhood gearing up for a political fight over its future.
It's under threat from the city's displacement policies, because right now with the de Blasio administration, they on one hand push for a very pro-developer rezoning across the city, you know, in the communities of color. On the other hand, refuse to pass protective rezoning. The Lower East Side in Chinatown is a perfect example, because the community has Chinatown Working Group rezoning plan. It's a community effort to put high limits and other restrictions on the neighborhood. So as a way to discourage luxury development from coming in, but the Blasio administration has said that the plan is too ambitious. So he'd rather just pass some small part in exclusion of a larger part to protect the whole neighborhood. Without a protection like this, you have seen hotels coming up, luxury developments like the Excel, these four towers. And also you see the tenant harassment and eviction that happened a lot in this area.
And you talked about the Excel Tower. There's one tower already been built there in this location close to the Manhattan Bridge side. What did they build there, and how is it different from the previous?
For that particular tower, it's outrageous, 80 stories. So it's definitely doesn't look like what the other buildings look like over in that area. And a majority of the units in that building are luxury housing. And then it set aside 20-some percent for the so-called affordable housing. But even that affordable housing, it's separate. It has a separate entrance. It's a separate building. So we see a very clear discrimination already there. And the affordable housing, if you look at the income level, it's not affordable to the community, to the people that live in this area.
What is the rent that they consider affordable?
They use the what's called the area median income, and it look at the income level of the all five boroughs of New York City plus the three counties upstate. So it automatically become higher this way. So in the area, there was a previous study that says that those who earn below 40% of this AMI in this area, it's actually quite a lot. It's a large percentage of people earn under 40% of AMI here. So it's not possible for people in the area to afford even in this so-called affordable housing.
You can't make below a certain amount in order to get the affordable housing. You can't be that poor.
Right.
Mayor de Blasio is supposed to be the people's mayor, but you're saying that that he's in fact behind this massive development of luxury housing in poor neighborhoods.
Yeah, because last year he did a town hall in the Lower East Side, and very clearly he said that he's not going to stop the towers. He said it's legally moving forward, which is a lie, because under the current zoning resolution of that area, you can't build towers that are out of scale of the neighborhood, and the city can only give the special permit only after the towers prove that they won't interfere with the neighborhood character, they can't add the traffic congestion, they can't affect the light and air quality and all those things. It's very clear that these, you know, four mega towers coming up would definitely forever change the neighborhood. The city can approve it, but the de Blasio say he's going to approve it. So it's clear whose interest he is representing.
You said towers, four towers. Is that four more towers than the 180-story tower that's already there?
Right, next to the 80-story. So that's one, and then the four more.
They're fitting this in the land that's spaced in between the low-rise, low-income housing that's there right now. They're actually fitting it in the yards and the common areas that were once, you know, that are part of these other projects that are already there, right?
Yeah, they use the parking lot, and then one tower even is going to be built on top of the senior housing.
On top of the senior housing? They're just going to build it above the senior housing?
Right.
To separate entrances for those tenants who are 40% of AMI and above the so-called low-income residents?
That's already happening for the Excel Tower, which is almost complete.
They don't allow them to mix with the people who can afford the rich housing.
Yeah.
What does the Chinatown Working Group want to do as far as rezoning, and what plans do you have in the future of, you know, public action or mass protests, anything along those lines?
A group of community members, they form a group called Lesson, Lower East Side Organized Neighbors. And they're the ones who did the research and found out the city is going to violate the zoning law. And also, it's going to bring a huge environmental impact to the area and also the areas along the East River. For example, because if you add so many units, it's going to cause the sewage overflow. That will impact all the other areas that share the same wastewater treatment plants. So we have a coming rally at the hearing that the city is going to hold to talk about these four luxury towers. It's going to be in October 17th at 120 Broadway. And we're going to hold a rally at 9:30 a.m. in front of the 120 Broadway before we go in to testify and say the city shouldn't allow these towers to go up because it's going to violate the law. The next step, if the city does pass the towers, we're going to have a lawsuit against them. And in the long run, we know that if we have the Chinatown Working Group rezoning plan, then we can stop these kind of towers forever. So that's something that we want to rally the whole community behind to push the mayor to pass the whole plan.
What is the Chinatown Working Group zoning plan? What's at the heart of it?
One big component is the height limit. You're going to put a height limit on the whole area. So whoever want to build a new building, you shouldn't surpass this height limit. So if the plan is there, then none of these 60 to 80 story towers will be able to come up.
Anything you'd like to add?
If the developers want to build on the public land, it should be 100% affordable. That means that the income level will reflect the local residents' income level. So as opposed to AMI that the de Blasio has been using. Because right now, across the street from Two Bridges, NYCHA, the city wants developers to build there too. That's why it's important to have the full plan, you know, to cover different parts of the area. So including the waterfront, including the NYCHA, including Chinatown and all of that. So this is one plan that I think, you know, we can galvanize the whole community around.
Ning says residents plan a spirited rally at city hearings on the project scheduled for October 17th at 120 Broadway. They plan to be there at 9:30 in the morning and stay all day. And the New York Police Department says it is investigating allegations that a detective improperly coached a witness during the Harvey Weinstein investigation. Prosecutors dropped part of the sexual assault case against Weinstein on Thursday after a witness said Detective Nicholas DeGaudio had coached her to stay silent about evidence partially contradicting the account of one of the film producer's accusers. Chief of Detectives Dermot Shea says an internal probe of the detective's conduct began a week ago. He says that as of now, DeGaudio has no active role in the Weinstein investigation, but remains on duty. And finally, jewelry with the toxic metal cadmium is showing up on the shelves of national retailers, including Ross, Nordstrom Rack, and Papaya, according to a newly released test result. Analysis done for the nonprofit Center for Environmental Health revealed some jewelry sold with women's dresses and shirts was nearly pure cadmium, which can cause cancer and reproductive harm after prolonged exposure. Earlier jewelry marketed to children were found to contain cadmium, prompting laws to limit the amount of the metal allowed to a fraction of a percent. And that's some of the news for Thursday, October 11th, 2018. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo in New York.
Hello, WBAI members. It is once again time for your local station board election. My name is Kiani Bria, and I'm your local election supervisor for the 2018 election. Your local station board members represent you, WBAI's member listeners, and help determine the direction of the station. The nomination period is open until October 24th, and you can get a candidate application package by visiting wbai.org. There are currently 9 vacant listener seats and 3 staff member vacancies. visit WBAI.org for more details and to nominate yourself, another member, or your favorite WBAI staff member. Stay tuned for other ways to participate in the 2018 Local Station Board election, which will be held November 15th through December 20th, 2018. Hello, WBAI members. It is once again time for your local station board election. My name is Kiani Bria, and I'm your local election supervisor for the 2018 election. Your local station board members represent you, WBAI's member listeners, and help determine the direction of the station. The nomination period is open until October 24th, and you can get a candidate application package by visiting WBAI.org. There are currently 9 vacant listener seats and 3 staff member vacancies. Visit WBAI.org for more details and to nominate yourself, another member, or your favorite WBAI staff member. Stay tuned for other ways to participate in the 2018 Local Station Board election, which will be held November 15th through December 20th, 2018.
Election Day is the first Tuesday in November. You still have time to register if you're a New York resident. The deadline is October 12th. If you're a college student, you can use your campus address. It's easy.
To register to vote online or to make sure you're still registered, just visit www.vote.org. Remember, the deadline is October 12th, and your vote counts.
Vote for me, vote for me. I'm the one you can trust, you'll see. Play your part in democracy. It's election time again.
This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and the WBAI, the WBAI, did I just say that? Let's start again. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online, and the previous program was the WBAI Evening News with Paul DiRienzo. And as you know, we are in fund drive mode for fall 2018, raising funds to make sure that this institution continues to provide you that unique perspective of the world that you expect from us here on a regular basis. But we need your help in order to do that by calling 516-620-3602. Once again, that number is 516-620-3602, or go to give2wbai.org online. Give2wbai.org online. And if you appreciate some of the program changes that's been happening, Driving Forces, which is one of the newer shows here at WBAI, that's hosted and produced by Celeste Katz and Jeffrey Simmons. And if you appreciate the efforts of what Paul has been doing, please consider becoming a financial supporter to this radio station. There's many ways of doing it. One of them is simply call up the pledge line, 516-620-3602, and you could give whatever amount you want. Or you could do the same thing online by going to give2wbai.org. Also, you could become a BAI buddy, which is a sustainer program for a calendar year. You pledge to give as little as $10 a month to the radio station, and you'll have the self-satisfaction of saying that, yes, I am being part of the solution to our financial situation here at WBAI. You'll receive a tote bag. You'll receive a membership card that will entitle you to perks and discounts at participating restaurants, theaters, gymnasiums, and so on and so on and so on. Also, you can also you could text to donate, texting WBAI on your smartphone, and you will receive a link, and the link will become a page on your smartphone, and it will ask you how much you want to donate to this radio station. You could donate as little as $5 by doing that, but yet every donation is tax deductible, and we thank you in advance. Stay tuned.